We've been in Ezekiel, and we are going to be looking at Ezekiel chapter 8. So if you want to kind of take a peek in there or have that ready just to, so that we can look through that. And I was thinking about this week, you know, as a kid, I just assumed that when we went to church, one of the things that people do when they come to church, this is just an assumption of mine, by the way, but people, when they come to church, one of my assumptions was is that they came here to worship, that's what we were here for, and that's what I had been taught. But I remember one particular Sunday, I was sitting toward the back. My dad was preaching. One of the elders was sitting just a few seats in front of me. And pretty soon I noticed his wife put her arm around his shoulders. And as I'm sitting there in the audience, I'm sitting back about, you know, where Ed is or even farther back, and he's in front of me. And pretty soon she starts playing with his ear and just kind of doing, you know, and rubbing the side of his cheek, you know, as we're there. And I'm thinking, now I'm about fifth, sixth grade probably. And I'm looking at all this stuff and I'm thinking to myself, here's what I'm thinking. He ain't worshiping. He ain't doing that. And at least I wouldn't have been. And in fact, I wasn't. And I had this awakening as I was thinking, you know, at that time in my life that you could actually go to church and you could actually, even though you're in church, you could be in church and not worship, and that you could be in the right place, but not be engaged in a process with God at all. I mean, it's just, I guess it's troubling for me to think that you can go to church and you can do that over and over and over again and yet never really be engaged in worship. I don't know why. Maybe it's more that I don't know why that bothers me. I don't know why that strikes me as or why I'm surprised by that. But maybe it's because, maybe it's more that it's a possibility. And that's certainly, I think, what's going on here in Ezekiel chapter 8, the text that we're going to be looking at. I just want to just walk down through this text here. Ezekiel chapter 8, and I want to comment on just on the number of things that show up in this text, and then I want to come back to that just a little bit to talk a little bit more of some of the things that, some of the ways that it implies for our lives, the implications it makes for our lives. But if you look at chapter 8, I just want to look, I look at this chapter here, and it kind of starts out kind of like saying, hey, it's November 8th, 2015, and it's time to go to church. I mean, that's basically what this first line reads. If you look at that, chapter 8, starting with verse 1, in the sixth year, in the sixth month, on the fifth day, while I was sitting in my house and the elders of Judah were sitting before me, the hand of the sovereign Lord came upon me there. It was Sunday. It was time to go to church. And in verse number 2, it says, I looked and I saw a figure like that of a man. From what appeared to be his waist down, he was like fire. And from there up, his appearance was as bright as glowing metal. And it's really the same description of God that occurs in chapter 1. I think it's verses 26 and 27 right around there. Same basic picture. Ezekiel is just kind of harkening back to that time, that thought of that picture of God there. He's basically saying, I'm in this encounter with God. And from what appeared, it says in verse 3, he says, he stretched out what looked like a hand and took me by the hair of my head. And the Spirit lifted me up between earth and heaven. And in visions of God, he took me to Jerusalem. Now, remember, he's in Babylon. Ezekiel he's not where he belongs. Israel is in exile, and Ezekiel, the prophet slash priest, is not in Jerusalem. But by vision, that's where he goes. And he goes to the entrance to the north gate of the inner court, where the idol that provokes to jealousy stood. That is such a troublesome line there. He has been invited into the very presence of God. He's been invited into Israel's temple, which is the place where God dwells. And yet the first thing that he sees is this idol that provokes him to jealousy. I mean, can you imagine what it would be like to walk into a church building for the very first time and the first thing you see is something other than an invitation into God's presence? And he says in verse number 4, he says, and there before me was the glory of the God of Israel as in the vision I had seen in the plain. And then he said to me, verse 5, son of man, look toward the north. And so I looked, and in the entrance north of the gate of the altar, I saw this idol of jealousy. And he said to me, son of man, do you see what they are doing? The utterly detestable things the house of Israel is doing here. Now listen to this line. Things that will drive me far from my sanctuary. This is where I belong, he says. I belong in this place, and yet these people are doing things that are, they're literally driving me right out of the space that I am supposed to inhabit. And he says, not only that, but you will see things even more detestable than that. In verse number 7, then he brought me to the entrance of the court. We're talking about the inner circle. We're talking about inside the temple grounds itself. He's brought into the inner court. He says, I looked and I saw a hole in the wall. Verse 8, he said to me, son of man, now dig into the wall. And so I dug into the wall and I saw a doorway there. Sounds almost like an Indiana Jones movie, you know? I mean, he sees this hole and he starts digging through that wall, and pretty soon he sees a doorway and he starts walking through that doorway into this kind of a secret place. He's going to have a glimpse of what's going on behind the closed doors of the temple. And he said to me, go in and see the wicked and detestable things they are doing here. And so I went in and I looked, and I saw portrayed all over the walls all kinds of crawling things and detestable animals and all the idols of the house of Israel. He walked in and he saw all of these images of creepy, crawly things. This from the God who said in the very first two laws, you are not to have any God before me and don't make any kind of idol for worship. And yet that's the thing that he saw in God's temple. But worse than that, verse number 11, in front of them stood 70 elders of the house of Israel, and Jaazaniah, son of Shaphan, was standing among them. Each had a censer in his hand, and a fragrant cloud of incense was rising. Those are prayer images. You know, all through the Old Testament, when they offered incense up before God, it was as if that prayer itself was transcending beyond the veil into the very presence of God. And here the leaders of Israel, not some foreign nation, but the very leaders of Israel themselves are standing there in front of these carved walls offering their prayers, not to God, but to these idols. These detestable, crawly, creepy kind of things and animals. And in verse 12 it says that he said to me, son of man, have you seen what the elders of the house of Israel are doing in the darkness? Each at the shrine of his own idol. They say, the Lord does not see us. The Lord has forsaken the land. Don't you just love it with kids? I mean, you play hide and go seek with them and all they do is go, you can't see me. You can't see me, right? And if they can't see you, then you can't see them, obviously. I mean, that's the whole trick of the game, right? And so they sit around as if no one can see them. And here's Israel saying, and the same thing, God can't see us, right? God can't see us. We can do whatever we want because God can't, obviously he can't see us. But yet it goes another step. It's not merely the thought that God can't see us, it's that God won't see us. I mean, they're having their own little pity party. Life has turned bad. They're in exile. And here they are saying, you know, God doesn't really much care about me. He doesn't care about us much. He's not paying much attention to us. And so because he doesn't take care of me, and because he doesn't pay any attention to me, I'm not going to pay any attention to him because my life's bad. Therefore, I'm just going to go ahead and do whatever I want. I'm going to turn my attention to some other God because some other God must be more powerful than this one. Verse number 13 says, and again he said, you will see them doing things that are even more detestable. And then he brought me to the entrance to the north gate of the house of the Lord. And I saw women sitting there mourning for Tammuz. He said to me, do you see this, son of man? You will see things that are even more detestable than this. And he brought me into the inner court of the house of the Lord. And there at the entrance to the temple, between the portico and the altar, were about 25 men with their backs toward the temple of the Lord and their faces toward the east. They were bowing down to the sun in the east. Men who had their backs to God and they were facing the sun and bowing down to that. They're in the temple grounds here. They're supposed to be worshiping God. And instead, they have literally turned their backs on God. Instead of looking toward God, instead of looking to the temple, here these people are bowing down in another direction with their back exactly toward God. And they know what they're supposed to be doing, but they're turned the other way. Now, we kind of expect that, right, in some circumstances. I mean, you think about, for example, in nature. I mean, we expect that. I mean, I love sunflowers. I think that they're absolutely gorgeous. They're just beautiful. I love fields of sunflowers. I like people taking pictures of sunflowers. And sunflowers do exactly just that, don't they? They follow the sun. That's why they're in part called sunflowers, I think. And they turn, and in the heat of the day, they just bow to the sun. It's incredible to see. It's just absolutely beautiful. And you expect to see that, I think, you expect to see that in nature because there's nothing to it. It's just that, you know? But the problem, I think, is that when men, when we start bowing down to the sun, as if the sun could somehow be a substitute for God, as if somehow we could turn our attention, to God and find our strength in some other place besides the God of Israel himself. And see, that's what Israel's doing here. The very people who are supposed to be worshiping God, who are the ones who are called by God to be his own nation. This is not strangers. This is the people of God, and they have turned their backs on God, and they're worshiping the sun. Look at verse 17. He said to me, "Have you seen this, son of man? Is it a trivial matter for the house of Jacob to do the detestable things that they are doing? Must they also fill the land with violence and continually provoke me to anger? Look at them putting the branch to their nose. Therefore I will deal with them in anger. I will not look on them with pity or spare them. Although they shout in my ears, I will not listen to them." God finally says, you know what? If they don't want anything to do with me, that's fine. I just won't have anything to do with them. I think that God finally reaches the point, reaches his place of intolerance, because God is literally outraged. He says, can you believe? Can you believe what they're doing? You see, the problem isn't that God is so into himself. It's that God so deeply cares about us. He cares about you. He cares about me. He wants what's best for us. He knows what's best for us. And so he just becomes outraged. Outraged when we turn our attention to something that is less than we should have. I want you to see the most unnecessary sign in the history of the universe here. You don't need the sign. I'm just telling you, I don't need a sign that says, "Reclaim water in toilet, do not drink." I don't need it. I don't need that. It's absolutely a waste of a sign. Because I'm not interested in sticking my head in a toilet to drink in the first place. I hope that none of you are, right? Okay, I don't care how clean that water looks in that urine. But you know, you've seen dogs do it, right?
Ew.
And in fact, I almost put a picture up there of a dog licking. And I thought, you know what? You know, we can't do that. You can't do that in church. That's way, way, way too much. It's a little over the edge for church. Would you agree? And yet, that's exactly what God's doing. That's God's image right there. That's what God's thinking. He says, "I offer you that which is valuable. I offer you that which is substantive. I offer you that which is important. I offer that which will give real life. And instead of accepting real life from me, you go and drink from the toilet." And it really outrages him. God gets so outraged, not because he's interested in himself, but because he's interested in them. And that's really the point. He cares so much about Israel that when Israel turns their attention to other gods, he's outraged that they're going to turn to somebody that can only hurt them and not help them. You know, I listen to this text, and I think about the things that outrage me. And I realize that how minor they are, you know. I sometimes get upset over just little things that really don't matter. I mean, like I'm driving down through Baroque or somewhere, I'm driving, somebody comes out in front of me in traffic and he just kind of takes up my space in that lane or somewhere. You know, he cuts me off. And I get all bent out of shape over that and I get upset and I want to step on my gas or lay on my horn or something like that. And I just think about, you know, things like that are just so trivial. They're just not that important. And sometimes I get upset over things that really do matter, things that I really ought to get upset over. I know, and I've seen this, you watch the news, and I've seen this here recently. I mean, any time that I'm watching and I see where children are being abused or children are being neglected or children are being hurt by some person, and they show that, and it enrages me. It bothers me. And I think about things like that, and I think, if those kinds of things really enrage me, what do you think God is going to feel like when we walk into what is supposed to be a worship space and something that belongs to him and we are everywhere except for in worship? See, I think that tension exists for us is that this isn't just about corporate worship, but it is. See, I think, you know, this is Israel's worship. This is where they come to meet God, and I think the real question is what goes on in worship. What goes on when you come to worship? What goes on in your heart of hearts when all of a sudden you step into this space? Because if worship isn't about God, we may well have come to church, but we may well have not worshiped. See, I think the tension is that this is somewhat about corporate worship, But it's really deeper about, it's really deeply about the private places in our hearts. It's about what's going on in here all the time, 24/7. Who sits on the throne of your life? And see, the issue of the temple of God is built around what's going on inside of a person because we are the temple of God. Right? We are the temple of God. This is where God dwells now. We have invited Him in as the heart of our life, into the center, into the very core of our being. And yet, if you're like me, then you're so easily distracted. It is so easy to find other substitutes for importance in your life. It's so easy for you, like it is for me, to find water in a toilet instead of the water of life. And it's not hard. I mean, it's just so normal. I just read this the other day. It's about strawberry pie. I love pie. By the way, our second annual Pie Guy contest is next week, man. So I hope you're thinking about the pie that you make. But I read this week about the strawberry pie. I don't know, I was on the website and I don't know how I got to this, but it says that, here's what they had on there. Every spring in Bavaria, people tie small baskets of wild strawberries to the horns of cattle as an offering to the elves. And I thought to myself, what? Just eat the strawberries and then butcher that cow and we'll have some steak, right?
Yeah.
I mean, somebody somewhere thought that made sense. And they allowed that to become a god. But see, here's a question that I want us to come down to is this. Are we not just as easily distracted by such things? You know, by things in our culture, you know, the arts and the sciences and the sports and the recreation and the houses and the cars and the stuff that we think give us our meaning. And what this text wants us to ask is this. Who is on the throne of your heart? Who is sitting in the center of your life? See, the tension is that this isn't about outside influence. This is about what's going on inside of us. See, I think what's so fascinating is what happens in the 160s B.C. in Israel. I love history. Antiochus Epiphanes and the Seleucid nation, they had control over Israel. And in order to keep Israel underneath their thumb, you know what they did? Antiochus comes in and he begins to slaughter people. And one of the things that he does is he offers a pig on their altar in Jerusalem. Oh boy. I mean, you can't get any worse than offering an unclean animal like a pig on a Jewish altar. And it's so outrageous to Israel that the Hasmoneans and the Maccabees rise up in total, absolute rebellion. And they take Israel back from the Seleucids and they hold it until the Romans come. It just incenses them because some outside nation has taken over Israel. But you back up 500 years into the time of Ezekiel's day, this isn't an outside force. It isn't some outside nation that's come along and taken over what Israel is doing. This is Israel themselves. They have compromised themselves. There are two words that show up in the book of Revelation regularly. One of them is saints. It's about us. It's about the people of God who have their hearts given over to Jesus fully. The other word is earth dwellers. Earth dwellers are those who have let the culture of the world so cause them to compromise because they're so afraid to be different that they do whatever the world does and they become just like earthlers. One of my professors used to tell us regularly, he said, our problem is not going to be persecution. Our problem is when we compromise. It's when we turn our back on the God of the universe and we start worshiping creatures on a wall. When we start making anything other than God the center of our life. And I guess that's my question. And I ask it of you. And I ask it of me. And the question is, who is on the throne of your life? Let's pray. God, it's so tempting to me to just think that worship is about singing a few songs and standing around and
maybe add a little bit of prayer to that or whatever, God, and to not recognize that worship is really about giving you honor with everything that's a part of our being. We can do that through song. We can do that through service. We can do that through just reaching out to other people. It's so easy to just limit our worship to what happens in this building and not recognize that worship truly is about who we are and what we're to be about, and that our lives every day, 24/7, are really to be in worship to you. So Father, I pray that you help us to focus on that and just to recognize that very fact that God, our lives are to be, in fact, that. We're to be, our lives are to honor and glorify you. Sometimes I forget that. I think we forget that. And I think that we bring in the culture, and we bring in the world, and we bring in our idols and all of our the things that we want to see happen, all of our preferences and everything else, and we fail to recognize that really what we're doing here, really what we're doing anywhere, is bringing honor to you, that we have an audience of one, our lives do. And so I pray, God, that you would bring us to that place. We can recognize you as the center of our lives. So help each of us to win that battle every day to put you on the throne of our lives. And to thwart our culture and the influence that it tries to have upon us. I pray this in Jesus' name.